Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. Greetings again from Osceola County in Florida to wherever you may be. If you're in California, I hope everything's okay. I'm grateful the drought is over, or at least it seems to be over. But we are concerned with those who have had to deal with flooding. You had fire during the dry spell, and now you have flooding during the wet season. So our prayers and thoughts and concerns go out to those of you who are part of this community who are in either Northern or Southern California. That entire area has had that issue of weather, difficulties with weather, whether it be too dry or too wet. So you are in our thoughts and prayers out there in California. The opening prayer came from the book of Revelation, which the Apostle John was inspired to write. I want to go now to the Gospel of John, to the fourth of the Gospels, as it is in our Bibles now, as they are in our Bibles. I want to go to John, the 10th chapter. John 10. And I'm taking out my calendar, and I know many of you have these. We distributed them at the Festival of Tabernacles. I just want to make sure that I don't say something that is inaccurate. Okay, I think I will be correct. So the night of the 16th of December on the Roman calendar, which is coming up soon, begins an 8-day festival in the Jewish community. The festival of dedication, or Hanukkah. That has become more well known in recent years than it was in earlier years. Although, if you have a Catholic tradition, 1st and 2nd Maccabees are in your Bible. If you have perhaps an Episcopalian or Anglican tradition, Church of England tradition, you may be aware of books that are normally termed apocryphal. They're not in the Old Testament canon as the Hebrew-speaking world has preserved it. And so most Protestants also, it's not in their Bible. But 1st and 2nd Maccabees you can find in Catholic and Anglican Bibles. And therefore you find it also in the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible that's used in universities. These are books written in the intertestamental time. Hanukkah is an intertestamental festival. That is to say, it began to be observed about a century and a half before Jesus Christ. And he indeed observed it. I want to go to John 10. John 10 and verse 22. So as I said, Tuesday night begins the 25th day of the ninth month on the sacred calendar. And that begins a festival, which I'm going to talk about today. But I want you to see it inside the Bible. Where is it in the Bible? It's not mentioned by name in the Old Testament. Because, as I said, the Old Testament was finished by the time this holiday began to be celebrated. The Old Testament had been canonized complete, not officially canonized. That came at the end of the first century, AD first century, when the Jews finally decided this and no more, these and no more. But Hanukkah, of course, occurs after the Old Testament is completed. Though, in very great detail, it is prophesied in the Old Testament. Which is why, if you study the Bible in a university setting, they will tell you the book of Daniel was the latest book of the Old Testament. And they will tell you because Daniel talks about things that happened about a century and a half before Christ. How could he have done that? Well, if Daniel had the gift of prophecy, he could do it. But if you're a secular professor at a university, that's not something you're going to consider. You're not going to consider that option. So you'll have to assume that Daniel, in effect, was pretending to prophesy and actually writing about events that were historical, or contemporary. So that's a matter of which way you want to go. There was a book written a long time ago called Daniel in the Critic's Den. And the book of Daniel, because it has so many very interesting prophecies, is either a tremendous proof of the divine inspiration of the Bible, or you have to take the other option that it is somehow not exactly a pious fraud, but bordering on it, you know. So anyway, that being said, I want to go to John 10 and verse 22, where we have reference to the Feast of Dedication. John 10 and verse 22. Now, by the way, if you kept the Festival of Tabernacles and the eighth day of Sacred Assembly, you know that John 7 talks about that time, and possibly all the way to verse 21, you're still in those 8 days, very possibly. Then we jump to the next festival, which is not commanded on the church, not commanded on ancient Israel, but the Jews in intertestamental times took upon themselves. the commitment to keep this festival, and they've done it ever since. So it is a part of church history, but not commanded upon the whole church. It's a Jewish festival, but the historical events are, of course, a part of church history. So we go to John 10 and verse 22. We're finally going to get there. I'm finally going to read it. You've been wondering if I was ever going to get around to reading it. Now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter. And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. So he was right there in the heart of the action, the heart of the observance of this festival. He didn't avoid it. He was there. You know, and so this we have taken as an example to Christians to keep national holidays when they're appropriate. For Americans, for example, many Americans commemorated Thanksgiving recently, and very likely people who consider themselves part of God's church also commemorated Thanksgiving as an appropriate national holiday to commemorate. We celebrate the birth of our country in America on the 4th of July, and many Christians, church members, however you want to define them, you know, part of those who consider themselves part of God's church would appropriately observe the 4th of July as the birth of the nation in which they live, and so on. And here Jesus was being patriotic, you know, as part of the Jewish community and keeping the festival of dedication, or Hanukkah, and right there at the very center of it, because what is dedication of what? Hanukkah celebrates the rededication of the Holy Temple, and so therefore the most exciting place to be would be at the Temple in Jerusalem, and that's where he was. My talk today is Hanukkah in history and prophecy. Hanukkah in history and prophecy. You know, if you look at the Hebrew order of the books of the Bible, you'll find Daniel comes very late, the 19th book, and it's a kind of transition to the New Testament. We have Daniel, and then after that, Ezra, Nehemiah, and 1st and 2nd Chronicles. I'm sorry, I'm making a mistake. Now, Daniel is the 20th book, I apologize. Because we have, still after Daniel, we have three other books, right? We have Ezra, Nehemiah is not 21, and 1st and 2nd Chronicles is 22, so Daniel would be 20, all right? The way I'm counting, I believe the books ought to be counted in 22 parts. Nowadays, modern Judaism counts the books in 24 parts. But if you're counting them 22 parts the way I prefer doing it, then you have Daniel as the 20th book. And then, as I said, after then Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and then 1st and 2nd Chronicles. So Daniel comes very late in the order of the books as most Hebrew-speaking people have preserved them, as they are in Jewish Bibles. So it's very late. And it is a kind of a transition from the Old Testament to the New, especially if you look at the Daniel 9, the prophecy there at the end of Daniel 9. But I want to go to Daniel 8. Daniel 8. This is a very interesting prophecy, and I think if you read the writings of Josephus, Josephus makes the claim that this prophecy was shown to Alexander the Great, and Alexander is prophesied in Daniel 8, and if he was shown this prophecy, that would be one explanation as to why he was so favorable to the Jews. He, I'm sure, he would be quite flattered to know that he's prophesied in the Bible. Anyway, in Daniel the 8th chapter, we find Daniel in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel. So you see, the author is Daniel. After the one that appeared to me the first time, I saw in the vision, and it so happened that while I was looking, that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. It's interesting when I read this now, whether the vision put him there or whether that's where he was when he saw the vision. But if that's where he was when he saw the vision, this area is now in southwestern Iran, and it was part of the Babylonian Empire ruled it. It was part of the Medo-Persian Empire at that time. The Medes and Persians had conquered the Middle East, and it was a part of the Medo-Persian Empire, and it did serve as a winter capital. For the empire, Ahasuerus had a center of administration there. You can read about it in the book of Esther. The river Ulai is contested among scholars as to exactly what particular river or canal it's referring to. But we, the general area would be, as I said, there's still a city there where Shushan was. It's not as big a deal now as it was then. But it's, I believe you could look it up in southwestern Iran. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a man, a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. The Medes and the Persians, and ultimately the Persians came to dominate that empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, first under Cyrus. And I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so it's coming out of the east, right? So that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver him from his hand, and he did according to his will and became great. And I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west. Oh, from the west! So this is now the Europeans coming, Alexander the Great. And a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. Quickly, right? He went quickly. He's compared to a leopard or panther in the in Daniel 7. Without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Alexander the Great. I'm saying, obviously, you know, he doesn't say that here, but you could, from history, you could look back and understand this. And from what the, later on you'll we'll be reading in Daniel 8, how the Bible interprets the Bible. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. Then was there was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great, and when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Now, if you know some ancient history, you understand what happened. Alexander the Great died. His kingdom ultimately was divided up into four significant kingdoms. And two of them are particularly important biblically because they were north and south of the land of Israel. There was an empire based in Syria, the Seleucid Empire, and an empire based in Egypt, the Ptolemaic Empire. And God's church, you know, the center of God's church was in Jerusalem in those days. And so God's people were between these two warring powers. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. We have this dictator, this tyrant, Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth, who's known as Antiochus the Great, a tyrant who came from Syria and persecuted the Jews. He persecuted those Jews who were faithful to their covenant. He gave, you know, he had goodies for those who betrayed the covenant, but punishments for those who did not. So we have two different ways that God's church can be persecuted. We can simply, you know, simply they can be exterminated, just kill everybody. That's one way to do it. And that, you see that in the Bible, and you see that in history. The other way to do it is leave them alive, but seduce them, pressure them, get them to assimilate. So they're still around, but assimilated. That's another way to do it, and that's what Antiochus was trying to do. Rather than just simply kill everybody, no. His idea was win them over. You know, if you can, you know, entice them, fine. Or if you have to pressure them, whatever you can do, but get them to basically become part of your system. So his approach was assimilation. So there's two approaches to destroy God's people, either physical extermination or assimilation. And assimilation was his strategy. Verse 10, and it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Yes, as a persecution of those who remain faithful to the covenant. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. He actually replaced the high priest with one of his own choosing, who would push Hellenization, who would push changing the way of life of God's people, making them conform to the general culture of the time, the Hellenistic culture of the day. So he replaced the high priest with a high priest who was, in effect, betraying the covenant, one of his, a high priest who would be favorable to him. And then he went beyond that, though, later. He even replaced that high priest with a high priest who wasn't even Aaronic, who was of the tribe of Benjamin rather than an Aaronic a member of the tribe of Levi. So he actually decided to make it completely a political position under his control, and he put his own high priest in power. Then he went beyond that and suspended the sacrificial system. Then he went even beyond that, as all of, most of you know, and he went to the place of sacrifice and offered an unclean animal, a pig, on the altar, which is the abomination of desolation. You know, how much worse can it get than to take a pig, put it on the altar, and offer it as a sacrifice? Now, he did that on a day which was celebrated as the birth of the sun god, because he thought of himself as the incarnation of the sun god. He was called Antiochus Epiphanes, God manifest, the illuminated one. And so his birthday, I think he celebrated his birthday at the time of the birthday of the sun god, and he had an idol set up. And one historian suggested the idol perhaps resembled him. So he had an idol set up, which would have been Jupiter, but also would have probably been Antiochus as Jupiter. And then he sacrificed a pig to it. So, you know, it's described in the Bible of the abomination of desolation. Now, when did he do that? He did that on the 25th day of the ninth month, the birthday of the sun god. So without being, you know, let's say, without being melodramatic, let's call that holiday a kind of proto-Christmas. That's when he did it. Now, if you know, moving ahead of myself just briefly, when the Jews were able to, with God's help, throw out his people and cleanse the temple and rededicate it, they rededicated it on the same day he had done this abomination. And so they rededicated it on the 25th day of the ninth month. So, In one sense, you could describe Hanukkah as the anti-Christmas. Nowadays, in American culture, the holidays tend to blend together. And, it's like one big holiday season, you know. Some people have Christmas, some have Hanukkah, some do both. You know, that's the way it tends to be in America now. Anyway, verse 12. Because of transgressions, an army was given over to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. So we did have a brief period of success. You know, there are times when tyrants have periods of success, and generally speaking, I have found in history that they're rather brief. Even Hitler, who accomplished a tremendous amount of evil, was only in power for a dozen years altogether and wound up a suicide at the end, and many of his leaders committed suicide or were executed or imprisoned. Verse 13, or if they, many of them had to flee and kind of live, with looking maybe back over their shoulder, so that they wouldn't be discovered. Anyway, verse 13. Now that's talking about Hitler. And by the way, Antiochus, in many ways was a kind of proto-Hitler too, in many respects. Although, as I said, his technique was not extermination, but forced assimilation. Verse 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 evening morning is what it should be. 2,300 evenings mornings. If we can have now a Hebrew text of the Bible, if you can see that, maybe you're seeing out there in electronic land, you're seeing Daniel 8:14 and then Daniel 8:24.
Be just a second,
okay. Is it 8? Maybe I wanted 8:26. Yeah, I'm sorry, 8:26. Daniel 8:26 and Daniel 8:14. If you're looking at it, the Hebrew is erev boker, evenings, morning, evening and morning. But when you have a number like 2,300, you can just use the singular form, and it is used for plural. So it's evenings and mornings, erev boker, and this refers to the evening and morning sacrifices because he cut off the sacrificial system, and he cut off, 1,150 of them. I'm sorry, he cut off 2,300 of them. Okay. 2,300, that's what the Bible says. He cut off 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices. Now, if you cut off 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices, how many days is that? 1,150. He began that, now the desolation occurred after he cut them off. There was a period of time when there were no sacrifices. He suspended them for 47 days. Then finally, when it came time for the holiday, he celebrated it with that hideous setting up of the idol and the killing of the pig. And so on that day, he defiled the temple in an even more severe way. He had cut off the sacrifices for 47 days. And now on December 6th of 167 BC, or for those of you who are secular, BCE, 167 before Christ, on December 6th, which was the 25th day of Kislev that year, he performed the abomination of desolation. Now 1103 days later, on December 14th of 164 BC, the Jews on this, which was that year, what turned out to be Kislev 25, the Jews cleansed the temple and rededicated it. 1103 days had gone by, and add that plus the 47 days when there were no sacrifices equals 1150. Is everybody with me? So there's 1150 days involved here. For 1103 days, we go from the abomination to the cleansing. And then 47 days of no sacrifices. So 1150 altogether, or 2300 evening and morning sacrifices. Is everybody okay with that? Yeah. Now, if you come from a Seventh-day Adventist tradition, this chapter has caused havoc in your community, because William Miller, a man whom I, you know, greatly admire, he got somewhat carried away and decided Daniel 8 was going to predict the second coming of Christ. First he decided it would be in 1843, then he decided it would be in 1844, and so we have the traditional great disappointment. But one thing Miller accomplished is that he put back on the front burner in the Christian world the concept of the second coming of Jesus Christ, or the second advent. And that was an accomplishment, because from that time on, in the Protestant world, particularly in America, the second coming of Christ has been part of many people's thinking. Unfortunately, people have been deciding, you know, it would come any minute, or they would try to predict when and so forth. They got, again, carried away by deciding when it was going to happen. It's important to know it is going to happen. That's very important. If you tuned in today to find out from me when it's going to happen, you know, you're in the wrong, you know, I can't tell you that, and neither can anybody else. If you read the Bible, you'll see that nobody can tell you that. God himself can tell you, and he probably has chosen not to. Anyway, let's go to Daniel 8, verse 14. He said to me, for 2,300 days, or evening, morning, sacrifices, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. What I suspect happened, well, two things could have happened. The Jews could have read this prophecy and decided, all right, we're going to do what it says. We'll cleanse the temple when it was defiled. And, in other words, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. They took it as a command. Or it may be they did it and then looked back and looked at this verse and said, wow, you know, this was predicted all along. You know, so it could be in retrospect they looked back on it. We don't know. At least I don't know. Then it happened, when I, Daniel, had seen this vision and was seeking the meaning, and suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he's dealing with angels here. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. By the way, if you ever are involved in having a vision, it's very terrifying. It's scary. You look at the reaction of people who had interaction with angels, and it's scary. So he came near when I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face, and he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now, there are elements of this prophecy that actually are fulfilled right before the second coming of Christ, but some parts of them were fulfilled in 167 through 164 BC, but not all of it. In other words, it was a type of what would yet happen. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, and he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. So, in other words, the fulfillment of this verse is yet ahead. You're not going to live to see it, is the implication. The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. You see, it's interpreted for us. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. All right? It's interpreted for us. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. All right? As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise, having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. So it happened in the time of Antiochus, but he was a type of what will yet happen. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. So he's going to have spirit help. He's going to have the devil, demonic power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. So this person is going to be persecuting the church as Antiochus did. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule. And he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. So this is beyond what Antiochus did, replacing the high priest. This final dictator opposes Jesus Christ, as you know. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. You could look at Daniel 2. Jesus Christ will return with the power of Almighty God and miraculously subdue those who oppose him. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which you see in 8:26, if you saw the Hebrew text, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. Afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. Well, now we can, because we have the historical background, and we can also look forward, and we have also material in the book of Revelation that helps fill in the picture. So this is the background to the Festival of Dedication. It was a critical time in the history of the church. At this time, there were members of God's church, you could say, living outside of the land of Israel. There was a diaspora, but still the heartland was there, and the temple was there, and the priesthood was there, and there was an attempt to assimilate Judea into a Hellenistic empire. And had that happened, that would have pretty much been the end of God's church. So obviously God intervened because he has other plans. Let's go now to Daniel 11. Daniel 11. And we're again talking about Antiochus. Verse 21, we'll jump in about how Antiochus takes over the kingdom from an earlier ruler. And in his place shall arise a vile person. But he doesn't seem to be vile at first. To whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Oh, he's going to plot. He's going to kind of undermine the situation and seize it in a rather out of the ordinary way. And again, if you want to look at Hitler's example, he never was democratically elected. Germany in his day had elections, and he never won an election in Germany, but somehow he managed through the manipulation of the political system to wind up in charge. And once he was in charge, he made sure that he stayed in charge. So this end time ruler, this Antiochus-like ruler will be plotting, and his rise will be rather astounding, the way he will suddenly come to power. And he will come to power at first as a, what's the right word I'm thinking of? As somebody who will be looked upon as a benefit to people. I'm trying to think of the right, benefactor. That's the word I'm looking for. He'll come across as a benefactor initially. That's not really what he's going to be. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. Oh, you see, he replaced the high priest with one of his own choosing. I guess I'll read on a little more here. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He's going to manage to attract certain ones, especially the elite of the society who supported him. He shall enter peaceably into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. Let's go down to verse 28. He had gone down into Egypt, and on his way back, evidently he didn't do so well when he attacked Egypt, so he was rather angry. So when he came back through Palestine, as it's called sometimes, he then took it out on the Jews. Verse 28, while returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be removed against the Holy Covenant, and he shall do damage and return to his own land. So he plundered the temple. He came back there around 170 or so and plundered there. And then he went back to Syria because he still wanted eventually to conquer Egypt. And he wanted to make sure that Judea would be secure so that he could conquer Egypt. You see, unfortunately, you know, you could say the God's people at that time were on a bridge between Syria and Egypt. So either you're going to be very strong with God's blessing and be a great power in that part of the world, the center of the where Europe, Asia, and Africa come together. Either you'll be a great superpower in that region, or you'll be a doormat. You know, if you sin and you don't please God, then you'll be a doormat. You know, it's one or the other. You're either a power or a doormat. You can't stay neutral in that location. Let's go now to verse 30. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south. Okay, he's coming from Syria down into Egypt. But it shall not be like the former or the latter. This is a unique period because now Rome intervenes. Rome is beginning to rise in the west, and Rome evidently sends ships and intervenes where he can't conquer Egypt. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved. And so what does he do? He wants to make sure that at least his southern boundary is secure. So he wants to make sure that the Jews are subdued, that they are totally under his control and with the program. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. You see, the Hanukkah story is not told that accurately anymore. In general folklore, or you know, the general pop culture. Unfortunately, much of the Hanukkah story involves a sort of civil war between those Jews who had abandoned the covenant and gone for Antiochus and those who remained faithful to the covenant, who had committed themselves unto death to be commandment keepers. You know, so it was not just Antiochus versus the Jews, but it was also an internal conflict. Assimilated Jews versus those who remain loyal. Verse 31. Now you have four points to consider here. First, he invades, military conquest, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. So that's the next thing that happens. The Gentiles come in and are involved in the temple where they should not be. That's number two. So you have a military invasion, Gentile intrusion into the temple, and then they shall take away the daily sacrifices. That's the third thing that happens. Military invasion, Gentile intrusion into the holy temple, and then suspension of the sacrifices. Then the fourth point, the climax, and place there the abomination of desolation, which I talked about. So that's the four points. Why am I stressing this? Because this is a model of what will yet happen in the future. You see, the history of Hanukkah is important for Bible scholars, for church members, for Bible-believing people. It's important to study those events because they are a model for what will yet happen. Now, I don't know in what form they will happen. They may happen quite differently, but somehow they will align with these four. As I said, it may not be exact. It may be in some ways analogous. You know what I'm saying? It could be an analogy there. I don't know what's exactly going to happen, but I know that if we are aware of this, it'll help us to understand when the events occur in the future that they are happening. We'll be able to see that they're happening. So it's important when this season of the year comes around that God's people review the history of it, that they go back to Daniel 8, Daniel 11, as I'm doing today, and if they want to do further research, they can read 1 and 2 Maccabees, they can read Josephus, they can get into the history of it. So this is a very negative time, obviously, because it looks like the God's way of life is going to be stamped out in the Holy Land. But the Maccabees arise. Now, they're a small minority. They represent the Philadelphia era of the Old Covenant Church. They are the zealous ones. I wasn't planning to turn there, but I think I have time to do it. Let's go to Revelation 3. What does God say of Philadelphia? Verse 8. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it, for you have a little strength, have kept my word and have not denied my name. So here are those who have remained faithful. They have a little strength. You know, the Jews sing a song in English, which is not like at all the Hebrew song. That, you know, Maos, or the famous Hanukkah hymn, the way they've translated it into English is quite different. But the way the English words go, they say, "And your word broke their sword when our own strength failed us." And that's true. The Maccabees had a guerrilla war that they were waging, but they were waging it against a great world power. And so the odds were against them, but yet they won. Okay, let's go back now. So they were great, very zealous. And that is a characteristic that should be part of the priesthood, the house of Levi, zeal. And these were priests. The Maccabees were a family of priests. Their father was Mattathias. And then we had Jonathan and Judah and John and Simon and Eliezer. We had the five sons. And Judah was the great military commander. He was the military genius through whom God won the victory over the Syrian army of Antiochus. He wasn't there directly, but he had sent generals down there, or soldiers down there under a general, and he was not physically there, but his forces were there, and they were defeated. But Mattathias died before the victory was won. So the victory was won by Judah and the four brothers. One of the other brothers was martyred as well. Eliezer, I believe, was also martyred at that time, but four of the brothers survived, and Mattathias died, and Eliezer was martyred during that period of time. May have been later, because the wars continued for a period until Judah became completely independent. And finally, first, they became independent from a religious point of view, their way of life preserved, their temple cleansed. And so it became fruitless to try to do away with the old covenant. So that became a dead issue. However, politically speaking, they were still somewhat subservient until a while later when they became completely independent. And that was the last time that Judah became independent, because by about half a century before Christ, they were under the control of the Roman Empire. So they had roughly a century of independence, and then they were under the control of the Roman Empire, and they were not independent again until 1948. You know, we had an independent Jewish state for about, as I said, about roughly a century, not quite. And then from 63 BC to 1948, there was no really independent Jewish state, except maybe a brief, small, one for a few years there when they revolted against Rome in the second century AD, but it was just, not the whole area, just a very small portion. So anyway, here we go. We're back. Maybe I threw out too many details, so let's gather up intellectually let's gather our minds back to where we are. I'm in verse 31. Of Daniel 11. "And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices, and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant he shall corrupt with flattery." You see, there were those that went along with this, that compromised with it, that jumped on board with these attacks on God's way of life. They willingly went along. "But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits." So there were those who stayed loyal, and God blessed them, and ultimately they were the winners. Now the next verse probably then carries it over into New Testament times and talks about God's church, which Jesus Christ established, as I said, about a century and a half later, because you read in verse 33, "And those are the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering." So this probably refers to the church and its early work and the persecutions that it had to deal with. So we go from the New Testament to the Old Testament times to intertestamental times to New Testament times. All right, is everybody still with me? So I believe verse 32 is a prophecy of the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, and then verse 33 takes us into New Testament times. Now, I spent a lot of time on this history because it not only explains the holiday of Hanukkah, but it also explains some prophecies that we're going to have to deal with at some point. Matthew 24 and verse 15. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Now let's understand that the original desolation occurred in the winter. You don't want to flee in the winter. It's chilly. It's rainy. You don't want to do it. And so he said, pray that you don't flee in the winter. It's possible not to have to flee in the winter. It could be autumn in the north and spring in the south, or spring in the south and autumn in the north. It's possible that no one will have to flee in winter. But they've had to flee in winter then. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. Well, we are not in those days. We are not in those days at this point, right? I mean, you don't see these things happening. So this is a side point, but I'll say this. In 1978, I've told this story before. In 1978, I was in Midland, Texas, on the way to Odessa. And I, you know, in terms of where it is in Midland, it was Midland approaching the route you take to go to Odessa. And Linda and I were having dinner with a young couple, and they said, "Is it too late for us to have children?" Could you imagine this? 1978. So here's what I told him. I said, in 1984, because at this time, as most of you know, the headquarters of the church that I worked for, that, you know, in whose ministry eventually was ordained, was based in Pasadena. And Daniel, our son Daniel, who was our graphic artist, he was born in Pasadena in 1983. You don't mind my revealing your age. He was born in 1983. Well, in 1978, these people said to me, you know, is it too late to have children? So I told them, I want to tell you something. In 1984, the Olympics are going to be taking place in Southern California, and the headquarters of the church will still be there. You know, so you could say I went out on a limb, but anyway. Verse 20. And pray that your flight may not be, by the way, that 1984 Olympics, Daniel was just a baby because he was born in 1983, and we took him to a soccer game that was part of the Olympics. Now, if you can imagine this, Morocco against Saudi Arabia. Could you imagine that? I'm sitting there watching a soccer game between Morocco and Saudi Arabia. It was at the Rose Bowl, part of the Olympics of 1984. And guess who was with us? Ralph Levy. So here's Levy and Kaplan and the Kaplan kids, and we're watching Morocco versus Saudi Arabia. Anyway, let's go to Matthew 24. And pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. And for then there shall be a great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for your elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So what's the signal for the beginning of that end time period, that last intense 3.5 years of overwhelming times? Well, the beginning will be that abomination. I don't know what form it will take, but I know the elements in Daniel 11, verse 31, and so somehow they will be fulfilled. I don't know how, but I'll be looking to see how they are fulfilled, whether literally or in some analogous way. Let's go to Mark 13 and verse 14. This basically repeats it. So let me just say that basically Mark 13:14 repeats it. You can read the passage there. It's a parallel passage. It may have preceded Matthew's account, depending on what scholar you want to listen to. But let's go to Luke. See, Luke is just very general about it. Luke focuses on a different point. Luke 21. In Luke 21 and verse 20. Now, one reason it's important to talk about these things is because people, unfortunately, what's the right word? I don't think they're playing games. I think they're sincere. But I don't know if they're sincere. I can't judge that. But a lot of people take these prophecies and do all kinds of things with them. Let's remember that we have to have a great deal of respect for the Bible, and we want to be careful how we handle the material. Is it in 66 that I want? Yeah, let's go to Isaiah 66. Again, I hadn't planned to turn there, but I'm inspired to do so. Isaiah 66. Thus says the Eternal, heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you will build me? And where is the place of my rest? Whatever we do for God, that doesn't compare to what he has, what he is. For all those things my hand has made, and all those things exist, says the Eternal. So because of me, I'm the source of all existence. I'm Yahweh, who is, who was, who is to be, right? I am that I am, right? I will be what I will be. Verse 2. For all those things my hand has made, and all those things exist, says the Eternal. But on this one will I look. On him who is poor and of a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word. We have to respect the word of God and not, play games or twist with it. We need to be very respectful and very well grounded in the Bible and not just go off half-cocked, so to speak, one way or the other. Okay, let's go to Luke 21 and verse 20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So he focuses on the fact of armies surrounding Jerusalem. That's something to look for. If armies are surrounding Jerusalem, then you know that you're in that period of time preceding the coming of Christ. Armies surrounding Jerusalem. And that's not the case right now. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. So Jerusalem is a place you flee from. It's not a place you flee to. It's a place you flee from. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't be pregnant, it just means it's going to be tough on you. But woe to those who are pregnant, and to those who are nursing babies in those days. There will be great distress in the land and wrath upon the people, upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about a time when armies attack Jerusalem, take prisoners and scatter them around. That hasn't happened yet. This is the invasion that occurs before the second coming of Jesus Christ. So it's a massive intervention by the nations of the world, perhaps the United Nations or some collection of nations, competing nations, competing armies, but somehow there's an invasion of Jerusalem, and then captives are taken, and then Jerusalem is dominated by Gentiles. And as it says, it's dominated by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Well, the times of the Gentiles have not yet started. When Jerusalem is invaded by conquering armies, and people are taken into captivity, and the city is occupied by Gentiles, then that will begin the times of the Gentiles, which will end with Jesus Christ's victory. He will liberate Jerusalem. He will liberate the human race. But the times of the Gentiles have not yet started. Now, these are things I know that you're thinking, why is he talking about this? You know why, many of you, because you've been students of prophecy. You've seen all the claims that have been made. So let's understand what the Bible says. Okay, so to summarize, the holiday of Hanukkah has that history. It's a time of the rededication of the temple, the time of the victory of the faithful ones to God's covenant over the forces who would destroy God's way of life, rejuvenation spiritually of the people of Israel, of the Jewish people, a spiritual rejuvenation, a rededication of the temple. And so it's a time to rejoice, and an 8-day festival was declared because they had not been able to keep the Festival of Tabernacles properly. So they decided to have a kind of poor man's Feast of Tabernacles. You don't go out in the winter and dwell in booths, but they lit candles. And these candles, according to some, perhaps parallel the sacrifices would have been offered. Well, first of all, they used to light lights during the Festival of Tabernacles, reminding them of how God guided them in through the wilderness in a pillar of fire. And so they used to light torches during the Festival of Tabernacles in Jerusalem. So the lighting of lights was in a sense a parallel to that. But it paralleled the sacrifices. And when you light the Hanukkah candles, there's 44 of them. And 44 in Hebrew, numerically, is the word dam, blood. 44 equals Dalet Mem, blood. So perhaps these candle lightings were done to remember the sacrifices that had been suspended. I would say it also symbolizes for Christians who are keeping Hanukkah as Jewish Christians, symbolizes the blood of Jesus Christ, which the blood of the New Covenant. But anyway, If you look back at the Festival of Tabernacles, if you go to Numbers 29, you'll find that the sacrifices were reduced from day to day. The 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, you know, 70 bulls were sacrificed in reducing order, and then on the eighth day, only one bull was sacrificed. And so the tradition of Shammai, Rabbi Shammai, was to start with eight candles and go down to one, and maybe that's why. But the Hillel was the winner. Hillel, who taught Gamaliel, who taught Paul, he said, start with one and go to eight. We increase all the time. You know, we're ascending. And so we go from one to eight, and that's been the custom. And there's a servant candle that lights the others, so that you light, you know, each night a servant candle lights the others. That's why, how you wind up with 44. You have 36 and then 9, because of the servant, why would I say, okay, anyway, no, 36 and 8, I'm sorry, yeah, my 36 and 8 is 44. And that much math I know. 36 and 8 is 44. So if you have the 36 candles plus the 8 servant candles, you come up with 44. Is everybody with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we have this festival of Hanukkah, which is known as the Festival of Lights, because they chose to celebrate it by lighting of lights for 8 days. Now, why should there be an 8-day festival? Well, one reason would be to remember the autumn festival days that they were really unable to celebrate. Another reason goes back to 2 Chronicles 29, and there you find that when the temple was cleansed and rededicated at the time of Hezekiah, there was an 8-day festival involved. 2 Chronicles 29, and I want verse 17. 2 Chronicles 29:17. Now when they began to sanctify on the first day of the first month, and on the eighth day, and on the eighth day of the month, they came to the vestibule of the Eternal. And so now things really begin to get more intense. So they sanctified the house of the Eternal in 8 days. And on the 16th day of the first month, they finished. So there seemed to be, particularly when they came to the vestibule, they were really ready to then sanctify the entire structure. And so there was an 8-day period when they felt like they were in control. You know, they had cleaned it out, set it up, and they had 8 days where they sanctified it. So that may be why the Maccabees chose to have an 8-day festival. Everybody there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you see, the holiday has historical significance and also it has a prophetic significance. I want to go now to 2 Thessalonians. There you see that this end time tyrant will be very much like Antiochus, and he will also consider himself God in the flesh. He's going to be expect people to worship him. Antiochus called himself Epiphanes. Now, before I get to 2 Thessalonians 2, I want to say something about Genesis 1. And if those of you who are watching this can see the graphic, Genesis 1 in the Hebrew. This is a little tidbit about Hanukkah. In Genesis 1, verse 3.
Three and four.
So if you don't have three up there, it's not your fault. Three and four. Then God said, let there be light. And there was light. Actually, I just need verse three.
Hold on, there'll be a second.
All right, so those of you who are watching this live can see the graphic. Or those of you who watch it later will see the graphic. Later on, we'll be doing these PowerPoint presentations where even those who are in the room can see what's going on. But anyway. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. So if you look at the Hebrew for let there be, that word is Yahi, which equals 25. Yud, He, Yud. Yud is 10, Yud is 10, He is 5. 25. So the Jews think that's interesting. Let there be light. And Hanukkah turned out to be celebrated on the 25th day of the ninth month. And it's called the Festival of Lights. Then if we keep reading, and there was light, Vayahi Or, you'll find that in that sentence, Vayahi Or, and there was light, the way it's written in the ancient Hebrew text, there are 7 letters, and that parallels the 7 candles of the menorah, in the temple. Now the Hanukkah menorah has, as you know, 9, because you're lighting it for 8 days and you have a 9th candle, which is the servant candle. But the actual menorah in the temple had 7 branches. And so in a way, and there was light, Vayahi Or has 7 letters. So it kind of parallels the lights of the menorah in the temple. All right. That's what I might call a tidbit. All right. Let's go now to 2 Thessalonians 2. And here, to save time, let's just say that if you read it, you'll see this man comes to the temple I don't know what that means in modern terminology. Will there be a temple sometime that he can come to? We'll see. Time will tell. Right now, if such a thing were to happen, you'd have World War III. Before the first brick was laid, you'd already have a third world war. So I don't know how this is going to happen, but it talks about a temple and talks about somebody claiming to be God and to be worshipped. And then I want to go to verse 8. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. And so we see that God is going to destroy this tyrant with the brightness of his coming. And if you look at the Greek text, which may be on the screen now, you see the word epiphaneia, the brightness of his coming, epiphaneia. And so this, you know, Antiochus called himself Epiphanes. Well, the real Epiphanes, as you know, is Jesus Christ, and he is going to come and be manifested in brightness and will destroy this tyrant with the brightness of his coming. We have the term epiphaneia there. This is 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 8. So we can take heart when we think about Hanukkah, because it's celebrated as the winter begins, as the winter season begins. And in a sense, it reminds us as we enter that winter season that what's the next season? Spring and the Passover season and the time of liberation. So during the winter, when in some ways we have the darkest of the seasons, it reminds us that ultimately God's people are the victors. God's way of life will ultimately be the way of life that people will live all around the world. So Hanukkah is very important, both from the point of view of history and from the point of view of prophecy. I think I can end it right there. I would say that the Festival of Dedication, I'm going to talk about it again next week, to be frank, but next week I'm going to talk about it from the point of view of theology, the theological implications of it. Today I talked about history and prophecy, Hanukkah and history and prophecy. During Hanukkah, God willing, I would like to talk about, and I rarely announce ahead of time what I want to talk about. I don't think I've ever done it. but next week I do want to have a second part of this series on Hanukkah, talking about Hanukkah, the theology of Hanukkah. Today, the history and prophecy of Hanukkah. And as I said, the Festival of Dedication, although not everybody in the church celebrates it, is extremely important from the point of view of history and prophecy. So for those of you who will be celebrating Hanukkah next week, happy Hanukkah to you. And I wanted to go now into the Q&A. Q&A. By the way, there are various ways to spell Hanukkah, and there's a whole book on the subject. Not only on that, how to spell that word, but how to transcribe Hebrew into Roman letters. There's a whole book on the subject. You have the same problem with Arabic and I suppose Chinese and so on, when languages have different alphabets and you have to go into the Roman alphabet. Anyway, regarding the Q&A, I've had some non-Jews ask me, they're part of the Christian Commandment Keeping community, and I've had them ask me how they would celebrate Hanukkah if they chose to do it. And here's what I would recommend, since they asked me this question. I mean, they didn't ask me recently, but it was a long time ago, but I want to bring it up now, because I don't know if I ever really answered it. I would recommend the basic ceremony involving Hanukkah. There are things that people do on holidays. You know, holidays are celebrated traditionally by people with the way they celebrate holidays. You know, you sing, you eat, you know, you do what you celebrate. But as far as the actual ceremony regarding Hanukkah, as you know, it's the lighting of the Hanukkiah or the Hanukkah menorah. And I would say this, the Jews have three blessings they recite on the first night, and then, two more, on the rest of the time. I would recommend that if a person wanted to celebrate Hanukkah, not of the Jewish community, I would say go ahead, light a menorah, and I would say recite just blessings 2 and 3 on the first night. Don't recite the first one. I'm not saying you can't. I'm recommending. And then the rest of the week, I would say the second blessing and not the first one. Then I think that'd be fine. If you're asking, you know, what you would do if you're not Jewish and want to celebrate Hanukkah, I would say have at it if that's what you want to do. And I would say light the candles and recite that second blessing, because that would apply to anybody. Is that okay? If you have any problems with that, then certainly I'd appreciate your input. There's time, because Hanukkah begins next week, so we can still talk about it during Hanukkah next week. Okay, now a second Q&A. And this has to do with a man who used to say, I'm almost never wrong. Now, one time I was wrong. I thought I was wrong, and it turned out that I was right. Well, that's what happened with me. You know, I said last week that Abigail had a son, Daniel. Then I corrected myself. No, it's true. She did have a son, Daniel. Remember last week I talked about Abigail? Let's take a look at Abigail. 2 Samuel 3 and verse 3. Verse 3. This is talking about sons. Well, let's go to verse 2. Sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. 3. His second, Eliab, by Abigail, the widow of Nabal. That's the Carmelite. That's as much as I want to read. Verse 3, part A. Eliab. Now, I would loosely translate that as a father's responsibility. That's, I would say, my paraphrase of what the name means. Once you have a son, father, you have a responsibility to the son. And that's one way, I think, to translate Eliab. I think literally it means father's restraint. What is father's restraint? I think it means father's responsibility. Now, in fact, you are restrained, daddy. If you have a son, you know, you need to be there for him. But anyway, he has another name, though. And that is Daniel. And let's go to 2 Chronicles 3. Now, my son Daniel has two names too. He's Daniel Solomon. In 2 Chronicles 3 and verse 1, I'm sorry, 1 Chronicles 3, 1. My apologies. 1 Chronicles 3, 1. Now these were the sons of David who were born to him in Hebron. The firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. The second, Daniel, by Abigail the Carmelitess. So he's called Eliab, and also he's called Daniel. Okay, so let's understand something else, though, what caused the confusion last week. And that is that he had a sister with the same name. So he wound up, you know, you could say, quote-unquote, falling in love with and marrying Abigail. He so admired her. It wasn't just a matter of romance. It was a matter of admiration. She was really quite a woman in every way, as far as her character, sterling character. But she also was attractive, frankly, as it says. So she had the looks and the character. But of course, the character is much more important, as we know from Proverbs 31. But I want to go to 2 Samuel. I want to go to 2 Samuel 17. And there you'll see that he had a sister also named Abigail. In 2 Samuel 17 and verse 25. It is. And Absalom made Amasa captain of the army instead of Joab. Then Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Jithra, an Israelite who had gone into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zeruiah, Joab's mother. So Abigail here is called the daughter of Nahash, Nahash may be another term for Jesse, or maybe he was an ancestor of Jesse, because Abigail was David's sister, as you'll see later. So she has Amasa. Now I want to go to 2 Chronicles 2 and verse 16. Or 1 Chronicles 2, verse 16. 1 Chronicles 2, verse 16. Now their sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail, and the sons of Zeruiah. Let's go to verse 15, because we talk about here the sons of Jesse. All right? Remember that Jesse had seven sons. The youngest was David. Right? So in 1 Chronicles 2:15, Ozem the sixth and David the seventh. Okay? David was the seventh son of Jesse. Now their sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. And the sons of Zeruiah were Abishai, Joab, and Asahel 3. Abigail bore Amasa, and the father of Amasa was Jether the Ishmaelite. So, here we see that Abigail was David's sister, and she bore Amasa. So that's where I got my confusion last week. There are two Abigails. One Abigail is the sister of David, and another was the wife of David. There were two separate Abigails. And so Abigail gave him a son named Eliab or Daniel, and Amasa, his sister, gave him the nephew Amasa. So is everybody okay with that? I said I would go into the genealogy, so I wanted to make sure that I had dealt with that. So that's our Q&A of, oh no, there's one other thing I have to talk about. This is very important. I want to go back to what I talked about last week, 1 Samuel 25. I got a question about what I covered last week, and it was a very good question, and it deserves a good answer. And this is in 1 Samuel 25. And I want to go to what happened to Nabal. Nabal was very wicked. He had a wonderful wife, but he was very wicked. And you know the story from last week, or let me put a plug in for last week's sermon. You can watch it if you haven't. And I was speculating as to what killed Nabal. Well, I didn't have to speculate about what killed Nabal. God intervened directly and took his life. You know, so somebody said, what are you speculating about? And I sheepishly said, you're right. He could have been as healthy as a horse, right? God intervened and just took his life. God chose to do that. You know, look what it says. This is verse 38. 1 Samuel 25, 38. Then it happened after about 10 days that the Eternal struck Nabal and he died. So, he, as I said, he could have been the picture of fitness. Yeah, I doubt he was, but he could have been. But if God decides your life's going to end, then your life ends. And he intervened. Now, there are some times in history when God intervenes and takes somebody's life. This is one of those times. It would be interesting to do a study of individuals in the Bible, this side of the flood. Obviously, the flood was a worldwide catastrophe, but just certain individuals whose lives were divinely taken would be interesting to get into that. And I do want to cover one case, and that's in Acts. Acts 5. I'll just, you know, briefly cover that. Well, I won't say much about it, but I just want to go to Acts 5 just for the moment. And here in Acts 5, we have Ananias and Sapphira, a husband and wife team. And unfortunately, they were a team, you know, in crime in a way. They lied to the apostles. They didn't have to give everything, but they claimed that they were giving everything that they, I guess, the proceeds of what they had sold. And actually, they kept back some. So they're taking more credit than they should have. Now, they didn't have to give it all, but, you know, they claimed that they did and they didn't. So they in effect were taking credit for something they hadn't done, and they lied to the apostles. And as it says here in verse 4, well, let's go to verse 3, because this is important from a theological point of view. This is what Peter says to the Ananias. Ananias dies, and then Sapphira dies later. But Peter said, this is Acts 5:3, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and keep back part of the price of the land for yourself? While it remained, was it not your own? And after it was sold, was it not in your own control? So we are not communists in the Church of God, you know. Private property is part of it, part of the way of life. While it remained, was it not your own? After it was sold, was it not in your own control? Why have you conceived this thing in your heart? You have not lied to men, but to God. See, you lied to the Holy Spirit. You lied to God. And he dies, and later, God intervenes, and he dies, and then later on God intervenes. Let's go to verse 9, and what happens to Sapphira. Then Peter said to her in verse 9, how is it that you have agreed together to test the Spirit of the Lord? Look, the feet of those who have buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out. Then immediately she fell down at his feet and breathed her last, and the young men came in and found her dead, and carrying her out, buried her by her husband. Now, why would God do such a thing as that? Well, you know, often in the beginning, God does very dramatic things to spiritually jump charge his work. I think in your own lives, you will often find that right after you're baptized, some dramatic miracle occurs just to let you know that you made the right decision. God does it. Now, there are going to be ups and downs in your life. But often there's some very dramatic interventions early on, as I said, to sort of push you, get you, jumpstart you spiritually. And that's been my experience, and maybe with many of you. And in this case, he wanted the church to have established right from the beginning, be honest in your dealings with the ministry. Verse 11, so great fear came upon all the church and upon all who heard these things. And I can continue to read one more verse here. because it talks about Solomon's porch, where I began my talk about Jesus Christ, about Hanukkah. He was in Solomon's porch celebrating Hanukkah, and here we are, Solomon's porch here at 31 AD or so. And through the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were done among the people. As I said, just tremendous miracles in the beginning to really jumpstart the church. And they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. So as I said, God did tremendous miracles, both punishing and rewarding those early days. And God is capable of performing miracles for us at any time. So we should be willing to ask for them in faith. So I hope that has, to some degree, I don't feel 100%. I may have even a little more to say on the genealogy next week to kind of wrap it up, but at least I've come close to wrapping things up on the Q&A. So keep the questions coming, and I hope hopefully God will guide and direct me in terms of the answers that are given. One last point I do want to bring out at this time, as we are about to enter for Jews the Hanukkah season. I really want to thank you for your interest in this ministry, and I realize that some of you are not only interested, but are also supporting this ministry. And I would ask those of you who are considering that you consider it very seriously, and I'll let a word to the wise be sufficient. So, in the meantime, have a wonderful Sabbath, and I hope and pray that the week ahead, we all here hope and pray that the week ahead goes very well for you. All the best to you and yours.